Our first presenter today is Tori Simonsen. Tori holds degrees in electroacoustics engineering and musicology, both from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology in Trondheim. He's an associate professor at the Norwegian Academy of Music in Oslo, teaching music history as well as music technology. At the Academy, he has recently initiated research into Norwegian musical artists preserved on shellac records. And, in his spare time, if he has any, he is the founder of his own classical record, Simax, classical record label, Simax. In 2008, Tori received his PhD with a thesis titled The Classical Phonogram, where he examines classical recordings in the light of newer ontological theories about music produced in a studio, like rock music, electronic music, etc. His presentation today is based on that work, and he discusses, among other things, how modern recording studio practices changes the way we think about documentation of sound recordings. Tori Simonsen.
Thank you, Mark. Can you hear me okay? This is not so much a paper as it is I wanted to share some thoughts with you, and looking forward to some feedback afterwards. I've called this originally the disappearing session, and we added a small explanation on it in the program. We called it the significance of sessions in discography. But having thought about this for a while, I have found another title also. So I will discuss with you the paradox of high fidelity. And I will do this by presenting for you three different recordings. And this is the first. Nice music. What you heard was Sir Edward himself conducting his own piece, Charisma. He wrote it the year before, maybe for this occasion. The music is not very well known, and the recording is not very well known either, but the session is quite well known because of a picture where we can see Sir Edward in the studio and the recording horn and at least some of the musicians, maybe all of them. And this is, I'm using this because both the recording and the picture is in some way how we look at the recordings. It's a picture of an event. This is something that happened, we couldn't be there, but we have a picture of it. We have an oral picture of it and we have a visual picture of it. With this I mean also that this picture is quite secondary to this real event. We should have been there, actually. The main thing is to be there. We cannot be there, so we have to go to this substitute event. We have to listen to it through a recording. This is, well, I can put up that title, The Picture of a Session. This is not the only way that musicologists were looking at recordings. Musicologists tend to look at music as something that lived in scores. If you could read the score, you simply didn't have to have any performance at all. You could just read the score. So the The second way that musicologists were looking at recordings was as some sort of a representation of the score. What Sir Edward himself was thinking of in this moment, we don't know. This is a piano reduction of the score. But for both these types of looking at recordings, this was something less than perfect. The perfect thing was to be there. Now we have good examples of both ways of presenting recordings in books and catalogs. This is a well-known example from the Encyclopedia, so which came in Britain in the 50s. Trying to list all known recordings of classical music, and we can see here, Carissima. Here, Carissima is one of the works of Elgar presented here. They do, in fact, also say something about the session year 1914, but that I think is mostly as a warning for the buying public. The other way of looking at recordings was, of course, the way we normally do in discography. This is a page, or a small sample from the page, of a discography of orchestra on records between 1896 and 1926. And here we have all the necessary details. We have the session date up in the right corner, the 21st of January in 14. We have the release date as well in April 14. We have, of course, the matrix number and so on and so on. We have even the coupling and the LP and the CD version of this, which this example was taken from, of course. This is the two normal things to how to present the recording. But let us listen to example number two. And yes, let us do that. So much better quality, and if we could use the picture metaphor, it's so much better picture of what was happening in the studio. But my question then is, can it be trusted? For so many things happened in the technological world at this time, which had the meaning of it was to make better quality in the pictures and the sound. But at the same time, something made it possible to manipulate the sound more. Electric recording, which this was an example of course, we could, for the first time, hear the low strings here, not low brass. But the balance could be manipulated, and loud instrument or soft instrument could be loud, and loud instrument could be softer. And a lot of other things, the tape recording, for example, could manipulate time. Could you trust time any longer? This here is a splice, tape splice block. I don't know if anyone of you have used a tape splice block. You have, yes. Yeah. Okay, that's nice. Nice to hear. And the multi-track recording. So for every step towards the better quality, the better picture, we had also more manipulation possibilities. So when we arrive at the high fidelity era, and sometimes in the 60s and 70s, we got to this paradox then, the paradox of high fidelity. The picture of the session was seemingly more and more transparent. Yes, the best seat in the hall. And close your eyes and you are there. And so on. But in reality, what we knew about what was happening was less and less. It didn't say anything about what was happening in the studio, what we heard. I tried to find a metaphor for this. I came to use painting. Going from a not so good photo to a very good painting. Could you trust the painting? It was maybe much better, much more lifelike than the photo, but it was painted. Someone constructed it. So this was the paradox. And after the war, we had, in addition to these two ways of looking at a recording on, we got a third one, and that was a studio construction. Now, the studio construction was a problem for musicologists because they had no source. They had no instrument, no musical source, no score, nothing. So what they tend to call it was it wasn't music at all. It was some other things, some art, audible art maybe. That was a mystery to them, how this should be discussed and described. And the first example of this, of course, was the electronic music from the studios in Köln and in Paris and some American universities. But later, or I had to say much later, other thoughts came on, and we had this book by Theodor Grzesik about rock music. Rock music is here not the style, not rock and roll, but is all kind of studio-based pop music. And he would call that also a studio construction, not anything that should be listened to by live musicians, but something that was made in a studio. And what I have found most interesting is this concept by the music philosopher Lee Brown, who has been writing about a work of phonography. Now, Lee Brown has defined this work of phonography as all the rock music, all the pop music, all the electronic music. He also wanted to include in this concept all jazz music on records. But in a footnote in one of his papers, he asked the question, isn't also classical music on record examples of work of phonography? And with that in mind, we can play the last... a nice picture. We don't know really of what, but it's nice. The recording company doesn't either tell us much about it. This is from the booklet. It says that it was recorded during the T-Day 6th to 8th April 2004. It doesn't tell anything about the edits, the takes, the multi-tracks, excuse me, anything at all. It doesn't say a word about the post-production, which is more and more important. So I have to conclude that this is an example of what Lee Brown would call a work of pornography. And there you are. So if I was going to take this seriously, the consequences of taking WP seriously is I have 4 points here. Works of phonography are something else than live music, which means that for the first time, I would say, recorded music is regarded as something on the same level as live music. It is promoted to another art form. It's not just a second-rate picture of something, which in my academy, I'm well used to colleagues that tells me that I should go to a concert because a concert is so much better than listening to a recording of a much better musician. So this is, in my view, he's promoting a recorded sound to an art form on the same level as live music. The origins of works of phonography are in principle not accessible to us. Of course, we know that it's not true, for we know a lot we have a lot of knowledge about sessions In principle, we do not actually have to know about them. There is the link between the source and us is broken. WPs have no history when listening. Of course, we know that isn't true also, because I can very well place, for example, the first recording in a timeline, just listening to the technical qualities. I can tell it's something in the acoustical era. But I can also say that I won't listen to that in that way. I just take it as face value. It's okay to me. I like this sound. And at the same time, looking at the performance style, of course, I can say that this was played in another way in the 1920s and the 1980s, and this has to be before 1920s and so on. But I can also choose to not care about this thing. It is present to me as a listener. And my last point is that all phonograms are indeed WPs and may be listened to in this way. For some, maybe this is a radical position to take. I don't know. We don't have to take it. I can choose when I'm listening to a classical record whether this is a memento from a concert made something, and I can say, okay, it's nice to have been there, and I can hear it. But I also might listen to this as something happening today from my loudspeaker, and I really don't care if the sound behind it happened 10 years ago or 50 years ago, and especially when now the picture quality has been so good, so it's very difficult to tell the difference in sound recording between 1970, 1980, 1990 and today. They are all present in my ears, and that's what I wanted to say, and thanks for listening.
We have time for a few questions.
Slowly, please.
In the early rock and roll years, they were always putting rock down, saying, oh, that stuff is edited together. They sing only one note at a time.
Yeah.
But when you look at the session sheets on the rock records, very rarely do they make, they may take the first half of one, the second half of the other, but they weren't cobbled together. Nowadays, a classical recording can have 200 or 300 edits.
I know.
There was once a letter to the editor during the stage in Gramophone when they were arguing about high CD prices in the early 90s. And a producer said, I was a very successful producer of classical recordings, and part of the reason why CDs are so expensive is because of how much post-production has to be done. I've just put out a very award-winning CD, and there was something, he gives a number, something like 237 edits in it, which comes out to about one edit every 10 seconds.
Quite normal. It's quite normal, I would say.
Can't they get better musicians?
Well, these have been used against the classical music, of course, that all the edits. And I like to quote Glenn Gould in this one. He says that good splices makes good lines. They don't destroy them.
Couldn't you find better musicians?
I didn't record it. When I saw Gramophone magazine hail the performance of this on this recording, I sort of patted myself on the back because I felt I was the performer. But one thing I was interested in, the worm paste we had printed up there.
Yeah.
Worm generally doesn't list acoustic recordings.
No, just...
The recording you played was 1929, so it's obviously electrical, and Worm only had one recording listed.
Yeah.
Well, they had the electrical recording listed, which was a 10-inch.
Okay.
The first one was a 12-inch, and Worm will list acoustics, but they put a little note next to it if it's of historical importance and of no further recording or things like the Gustav Strauss.
Right.
But in this case, it obviously was a further recording because he played the 1929 recording.
No, he played the two sequentially.
The first one was 1929.
The first was a 14, the second was a 29 recording.
Yeah, so there's two recordings of it.
Yeah.
We wouldn't list the acoustic version.
They listed the 10-inch one.
But they said 1914 besides the one they listed.
That was the date of composition.
Okay, so Worm didn't list the acoustic one. This was the electric one.
They let the Gramophone Shop Encyclopedia take care of some of the records of the earlier ones. The preface says we're a supplement in a sense to the Gramophone Shop Encyclopedia.
The second listing you showed up there showed Pearl reissues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But HMV reissued them. Like they had two huge Elgar boxes, which did all the Elgar recordings. Mm. And I'm surprised they didn't mention that in that list of reissues. And those have also been issued on CDs.
Yeah, well, I had a lot of trouble finding those Pearl CDs, I tell you.
But have you seen the brown box, the HMV boxes?
No.
They came with a hardcover book. And
okay, no, I didn't see that.
And it was six LPs.
Okay.
Talk amongst yourselves, I'm going to go find your next speaker.
Yeah?
Doesn't the capture itself changes the reality, right?
Yeah.
It's still, I understand what you're talking about phonons, but when you actually do the recording from the very beginning, even if it was attempted to be exactly that, it would never be that. And the act of capturing it changes it in some way.
Obviously, yes. Yeah, even from the very beginning. Yes, Steve.
There's one other place to discriminate here, which is records that are made in the studio where the sound begins by instruments pushing air, and those that begin with instruments pushing electrons.
Mm-hmm.
And you have two completely different, because with the second, you have no locus to go back to.
Nope.
People say, oh, that's a great audio system. My Pink Floyd records sound wonderful on it. But you have nothing, there is no standard. Where with one that begins by pushing air. You start with the piano, you know what Steinway more or less sounds like, depending on the miking and all the other variables. But at least you have a place to begin, and with the other, you no longer have, so it's an even more of an artificial creation.
Yeah, absolutely. It is an art form.
I've always said I'm a recording engineer, location recording, and my role is to capture and
of course,
it.
Yes.
But
that's what how we looked upon recording. It was to capture the hall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Looking
there's
for
an
the
endless debate about, you know, live performance versus recorded performance, and whether the recording is a performance at all. Should you leave the errors in rather than editing them out and covering them? Which I think you should. I mean, if you had a score, you wouldn't leave a wrong note there just because it was printed wrong.
Absolutely.
I'll disagree with you in the fact that this can't be an endless debate. Because we do need to move on. Thank you, Tori.